Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is William Gibson, whose latest novel is Zero History. Recent novels include Spook Country and Pattern Recognition, which form a kind of trilogy, which we'll talk about, 9 novels in all. Noted, of course, for that first novel, Neuromancer, which showed us a cyberspace world. William Gibson, Zero History is the third of this kind of trilogy. It features characters who surround a man named Beijun, or Big End, a kind of mysterious figure who you call as a combination of Marshall McLuhan and a Bond villain at one point. When you were writing the first in the series, Pattern Recognition, did you have any thoughts that this would continue on?
Honestly, I never know, and I suspect that people don't believe me when I say I never know, because I now have this record of having written three book sets, not trilogies. As someone with science fiction as my native literary culture, I think of trilogies as being very long novels published as 3 volumes in which the second volume is really dull. But they're kind of overlap. They're sort of 3 books that are laterally related. As I'm going, you know, if I find myself doing that once again, I make an effort to write a book that you could read without having read the preceding books. And I kind of like the idea that occasionally there may be people who wind up reading them in reverse order. That would be a different experience, but it could actually be kind of interesting. With Pattern Recognition, I thought it was a one-off experiment, because I was going to try to use my pretty much standard issue science fiction writer toolkit to pick up and try to interrogate the present, as though the present was a sort of alien planet.
And then what prompted you to move on to Spook Country?
Well, my satisfaction with the initial experiment. Part of that satisfaction derived from a sense of, at least to my own satisfaction, having taken the measure of the particular zeitgeist that Pattern Recognition sprang from. And we seem to have moved on to the time I was writing Spook Country to a different zeitgeist. So Pattern Recognition was more or less immediately post 9/11. Spook Country would be, I suspected, deep Bush era Iraq war. And when I started working on Zero History, I found I couldn't really get that much of a handle on what it was, other than its kind of global financial catastrophe collapse. But somehow, at the same time, business as usual, global financial collapse, somehow didn't seem anomalous. It seemed kind of familiar. It's like, oh, that's always happening, but it just all happened at once.
You've talked about the world being at some kind of nodal point with the global financial crisis, and lately called it a nodal alley, many nodal points. What exactly do you mean by a nodal point?
The nodal point concept, I've gotten, you know, lamentably loose with that, and I actually, because other people have started using it. I introduced the nodal point concept in my second 3-book set of novels as an event that is a real game changer in terms of history. But in those books, the game-changing event is supposed to be, rather mysteriously, something that wouldn't necessarily be a famous event. Sort of like the butterfly effect, some small change and then everything is different. And only because I had a character named Colin Laney who could hook himself up sufficiently thoroughly to the internet that he could perceive these like knots of happenstance in the fabric of digital history. And he could also sort of see them coming. But, you know, in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, I thought, if that's not a nodal event, I don't know what is. There's a better term for it, actually, that my friend and colleague Bruce Sterling came up with 15 years ago, and we were together in the CNN studio in Atlanta, and I had never been there before. And Bruce went into the gift shop and bought two souvenir CNN shot glasses and proudly came out with them. And he said, I'm going to put these on top of the television set so my wife and I can toast one another with a little bourbon after the next CNN moment. And he then went on to explain his concept of the CNN moment. And he said it was when something so utterly hairy and weird and unexpected happened, and you saw it on CNN, he said it was like you were shoved right up against the windshield of futurity. And just for a moment, you realized how weird the world really was. And then some kind of self-preservation mechanism took hold again, and the weirdness was, you know, was drawn back to that point in the background where we find it bearable.
Well, I keep thinking that in the 24/7 news cycle, where there's always need for fodder, that what happens is we get, you know, almost a consistent series of false nodal points. So you start wondering, what's the difference? I mean, at this point, after 15 years, Sterling would be very drunk.
Yeah, although I would give him credit for being able to distinguish the faux nodal from the real thing. And you know, you're indeed right. Our news media today strive to constantly simulate the nodal.
The other problem I see is something, you know, remember the term future shock. You've got so many nodal points and the world is changing so fast that we're beyond future shock at this point. We can't be shocked.
Yeah. Yeah, we're numb. Perhaps it's good that we are. We might find ourselves unable to function or less able to function. We'd be like a pathological awareness. There would be no present. There would just be this constant exponential emergence of new stuff.
William Gibson, Zero History also takes into account two other characters named Milgram and Hollis, and they were the primary characters in Spook Country, which means that you were kind of continuing the Spook Country riff, though moving into a different realm, which is the realm of what you call postmodern marketing. Where did that come from, and why did you decide to focus, in fact, on characters that you'd already focused upon?
They forced themselves upon me. It's not that I make decisions about what characters are going to be in the book. It's like I issue a sort of casting call. I open a casting window and go, okay, doing this book, and this is so all I know about it. Who's going to be in it? And sometimes it will be some total stranger, and sometimes it will be a familiar figure, and I always greet the arrival of a familiar figure at the casting window with a certain sense of dismay and even embarrassment, like, oh no, what will people think? She's back. They'll think I have no imagination. But when I subsequently can't make her go away, then I start to realize that, you know, there's quite a bit of water has gone under the bridge since I last saw her, and her circumstances have changed. And in fact, she's no longer exactly the same character that I was dealing with before. And then it starts to cook for me. If I'm writing anything that's going to be any good at all by my own standards, there will have been virtually no rational, conscious decisions on my part. And that's the extent to which I have that going on now, is the fruition of a long process that began when I read a long essay by E.M. Forster on the art of the novel. Forster said that a novelist in control of his or her characters hasn't even begun to grasp what it is to actually be writing a novel. When your characters are making things really, really difficult, if not impossible, for you, then you're fully engaged as a novelist.
And when they do that, it means that the plot won't necessarily go where you want it to go. It's got to go in some other direction if you're going to follow, you know, stay on the river in your canoe.
All I have is a river. I never have a map, so I never know where the river's going to go. The guy who's talking to you doesn't have anything like conscious access to the parts of me that caused that thing to happen. It's a kind of relatively benign, self-induced, altered state.
Milgram has a smartphone. I forgot the name of what he calls it. I don't know if that one's real.
A Neo, yes, it's real.
It is real.
Although I think the company's gone. I could be wrong about that. Okay. There was a bankruptcy while I was actually writing the book, so that made it into the book. But it's a very dodgy piece of equipment,
to say the least. And then you have these odd penguins. Are they real?
Yes, yes. They're made by a marvelous German company called Festo that engineers them exclusively using the principles of biological organisms. So it swims the way a penguin swims. Their manta ray moves the way a manta moves. They have a jellyfish that didn't seem dynamic enough to want to find a place in my story, but you can search for them on YouTube where they have, like, astonishing promotional videos, and it was where I first saw them.
And Beijun uses the penguin as a surveillance device. I mean, is that standard, too?
No. Not only is it not standard, it's wildly impractical. The other aerial surveillance drone, aerial surveillance vehicle that they use, which sort of looks like a flying cocktail tray with eight little helicopter rotors, is something you can buy off the internet for about $1,000, and you can control it with your iPhone, and they'll be in retailers like Future Shop next year for under $500. And when that happens, quite a lot of what we instinctively regard as privacy will be over. People in very tall buildings, for instance, can't have any confidence that they aren't being spied on by Peeping Tom standing on the sidewalk below, who could, you know, with no trouble at all, send their little lunchbox-sized drone up to the 53rd floor to have a look in your bathroom window.
I'm reading this book, and there's a scene with Milgram and his Neo, and then he's on Twitter, and then he opens up a computer, and he begins to, you know, check this, that, and the other thing. And I went, holy cow, I'm reading a science fiction novel from 15 years ago, only it's today, and
yeah,
this is where we are.
Yeah. Well, you really, when you had that experience, you connected with something that, for me, is really central to the nature of that book's text. That's exactly the oddly inverted science fiction experience that I was hoping to induce. And I regard the fact that you experienced it as proof of the success of my experiment, however worthy or not that experiment may have been.
A friend of mine was reading the book, and what she said is she saw something different. She saw that you'd finally come to this weird convergence of science fiction with the present. It's like science fiction in this book, as opposed to necessarily the previous two books, had finally caught up to history, and all you can do at this point is go with history.
She may be right. That's occurred to me, too, and I've thought about it, and I'm not sure. I don't see why it wouldn't be possible for me or for someone else to do the same thing in 10 years to whatever history is 10 years from now. Nothing would delight me more than if this would come to be seen in some way as having been a significant move in taking what we used to call science fiction wherever it's going to go next.
You're listening to an interview with William Gibson, whose latest book is Zero History. Your book, Zero History, also contains a lot about this postmodern marketing. In an interview in the Wall Street Journal, you said we're in a post-industrial society. We earn our keep through branding and marketing. And I was thinking, wow, we create nothing.
We only create nothing from the point of view of an industrial society. the pre-industrial societies to which we farm out the physical manufacturer of the goods which we will brand and market, they don't want to be making those goods. They want to be doing what we do. We're the top of the food chain. You're right in the sense that we create nothing, but I don't think it's literally true that we create nothing. I think we're doing something. The proof of that is that we do very well at it.
Well, we also did nothing in the stock market, and eventually the nothing caught up.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. That was about sort of Borgesian or Escher-like financial instruments that amounted magically to less than zero.
Right.
That was truly spooky, and I wish that I had understood it more. I wish I'd had a little better understanding of that when I was writing Zero History, because a big end would then have had quite a bit to say about it. As it is, someone says, oh, those Icelandic internet bankers did it. They were all ripped on ecstasy. What I was hearing a couple of years ago in London from young advertising guys and video directors in Soho who were going to Iceland every weekend just to party, was that that was in fact the case. They all come back and say, well, I met the head of the central bank, man. He was ripped. We were at a rave together. His eyes were like pancakes. Totally nice guy.
And the result is that Iceland went bust.
Yeah. You know, they're having to reinvent themselves big time.
The focus of the book, one of the focuses, is on super exclusivity in the world of fashion. You've said that, in talking about cool, what's cool, that it's become net-driven, post-geographical, and of course, exclusivity is all about being cool. And I keep thinking that as I get older, cool means less and less to me, and I'm not sure why, even as it seems to take over the world. I don't know. Is that your perception?
I think that, well, there's nothing creepier than an old guy who's cool.
Yeah.
I mean, there's that, and we all sort of, most of us know that instinctively. You don't, as an English friend of mine once said, want to be the oldest guy in the club when the lights go up. Cool's natural demographics is when you're young. But exclusivity is not so much about cool, it's just about being exclusive. Most people are excluded from exclusivity. That's how it works. But the global luxury goods industry that has sold itself traditionally with exclusivity has done such a good job selling itself, making its product ubiquitous, that their claims to exclusivity have started to look ridiculous. And they look ridiculous to teenagers. If you say to a teenager, look at those Prada sneakers, they cost $5,000, aren't they cool? And the teenager, if he's smart, will say, well, how can they be that cool if they're in my local mall? Well, what's cool about having $5,000? I want some sneakers that nobody can get. That's how the secret brands idea actually works, where you trump the Prada with X. When you leave the club, people say, wow, he was rocking Prada sneakers. People go, what the hell was that on his feet? I've never seen anything like it. That sort of trumps it.
Well, wouldn't the ultimate trump then be ads for an exclusive product that absolutely never existed and you could never buy?
I've heard rumors to the effect that one very well-known Japanese fashion brand several years ago created a secret brand which doesn't, in fact, exist. But they occasionally offer items in their flagship store that appear to indicate that that brand does exist. Like they'll sell you a Rolex watch with the trademark of a possibly non-existent brand added to the dial. Very expensive watch with this little extra bit of signage on it, that keeps the legend of that brand going. But the friend who told me that said, there is no brand. That's the secret.
And, of course, at the other end of it, of course, is you can't sell the brand if it doesn't exist. So in a capitalist society, at a certain point, the only purpose of creating a brand that doesn't exist is to sell another brand that does.
That's true. And people, the only people I've met who've used anything like this strategy themselves have used it to leverage themselves into other positions. The cachet of the secret brand they've created gets them jobs designing for other brands, for instance, in one specific instance. And it gets it very effectively. The designer who does that, I don't think he'll ever sell the secret brand because it's his ace in the hole. As soon as he sells it to a multinational, it's not secret anymore.
The characters of Milgram and Hollis, both, after a while, as they wend their way through London and Paris and through Big N's machinations and searching for secret denim, I get the feeling that underneath it all, what they're saying is, on some level, get me out of here. This is a load of bull. And I'm just wondering, is that when you step aside, that seems to be almost a subtext because your characters are seeing right through it.
There are lots of things in the world that we can see right through, but which are very, very powerful in the world and which we can't make those things go away by declaring them ludicrous. Like often the emperor continues to traipse around naked, as perhaps he must in order for our society to continue.
The Gabriel Hounds, that's the brand of clothing.
Yeah.
What brought you to that title?
I was reading a compendium of British folk tales. It's a beautiful, thick paperback that Penguin published a few years ago. And I had run across the legend of the Gabriel Hounds, which is not the jeanswear legend, but the legend of these things, spectral things in the sky chasing the souls of unbaptized children. And when I needed a name for the brand, that suggested itself. It originally suggested itself to me as the title of the novel. But when I Googled it, I found that there was a Mary Stuart novel called The Gabriel Hounds. There had been several bands called The Gabriel Hounds. It was too good a name to have gone unused. I made it the Jeans brand. And I was actually very happy with how that works out because the story in the end of how it came in the book, how the Jeans brand came to be called that, I thought was pretty convincing.
And the name Zero History that you finally chose?
It came from a conversation I had with a law enforcement officer of sorts about what Milgram's situation would be if Milgram were a real person. He said, if I met someone like that, I'd go to Choice Point and Zero History. The guy hasn't had a credit card for 10 years. You see that? Either it's drugs or it's something more serious. Okay. I took it from that that it was police talk. But I also saw that its potential for ambiguity is good. I like titles that are open to the reader's interpretation or my own as I write the book.
Well, rather than Googling William Gibson and getting your own website, I decided to Google zerohistory.com and got this bizarre page of an explanation of Zero History, apparently created by students at Warwick University in 2008, that Zero History is a time when we should stop writing history entirely because it makes no sense and we learn nothing from it.
That's completely new to me. I thought that one of the things that would come to mind would be that neoconservative notion of the end of history. Right. That history ended with the fall of the Soviet Union, and you know, it's been so abundantly demonstrated in the past decade that that's that's not the case. That, you know, I can't see how anyone could take it seriously.
We can see how technology and how we move through technology is a character in Zero History, but the action takes place almost exclusively in Paris and London. And was there a reason why you chose those two cities, and are you seeing them kind of as characters in the context of the book?
Place is really important to me when I write, but I don't get to choose place. The book sort of begins where it begins, and then it gets to go where it goes. I remember wondering when I was in the first couple of chapters, well, you know, will they get to go back to Tokyo, or... And then I began to think, well, they're probably going to New York or perhaps Chicago or Detroit, which would be interesting. But they never needed to get there. Paris, not quite as much, but I think London becomes a character in the book. It's the largest city in Europe. Major, major world banking capital, no matter what happens. You know, its strength and centrality as a banking center have relatively little to do with British government or England as a nation. It's where business is done. It's evolved to do that sort of business.
William Gibson, one time when I was interviewing you, I mentioned the movie Blade Runner, and you said, oh, my God, it's as if they ripped a hole in my head. How do you feel about the movie Inception?
I loved Inception. I was so happy on leaving the theater that such a thing was possible. I was actually surprised afterward to see so many people on the internet saying that I had been an obvious influence. I thought that the obvious influences on Inception were obvious influences on me, rather than the other way around. Although, sometime later, one of the special effects people on Inception turned up on Twitter and made a point of saying that two of the shots in the film, one was inspired by something in Neuromancer and one was inspired by something in Idoru.
Do you remember what those were?
Paris curling up like old linoleum, and the city, the collapsing city on the beach, which seemed to me to be so Chirico, J.G. Ballard, that I didn't look at that and say, oh, that's like my imagination. I thought that's the most Ballardian thing that's ever been rendered in film.
What I got is that if you translate those dreams away from dreams into cyber reality, you know, and it doesn't take too much to see that, then it becomes William Gibson.
Yeah, if you look at them, they're like, if you look at them as the constructs in my first three books, which were just like very, very fully realized virtual realities. What it did for me, though, was that it took those notions out of a science fiction context as I and numerous other people have imagined it over the last 20 years, and simply put it back into the biological function of the human psyche. Like a really smart 19th century person, on having the plot of Neuromancer explained to him, would look at the virtual realities in the book and say, those are dreams. And he says, no, those are virtual reality. And you say, no, they're dreams. You're describing dreams. That struck me as a brilliant move. Something that really struck me about that film is how extraordinarily difficult it would be to render that narrative as prose fiction. Ordinarily, it's all too easy to render the narrative of a film as prose fiction. But with Inception, it would be like seriously difficult to depict in prose what we've been able to experience as cinema in that particular film.
William Gibson, before we went on the air, we were talking a little bit about Twitter, and you're a big Twitter guy, and I was saying that I looked at your Twitter page, and I was thinking of getting on it just to send you a message, not that you would necessarily have received it, about an hour before we went on the air. I looked at it, and I've seen other Twitters, and it seems to me that after about 5 to 7 minutes, that's it. And you were explaining that if you pick your Twitter friends wisely, then it becomes a very different multidimensional experience.
I think Twitter is one of those human activities that isn't comprehensible unless you've been able to go fully participatory. My version of how one customizes Twitter is that one skips around on Twitter long enough one way or another to find about 70 people to follow, which creates a constant feed of their observations. Mostly, actually not so much their observations, but simply that they're gesturing toward interesting things. Most of the tweets that make it into my feed are simply links to pages on the web. For me, it serves as this incredibly efficient aggregator of novelty. As filtered by, 70 people with a really acute eye for that sort of thing.
The other side of it, I think, is there was a baseball player who made some comment about partying, and immediately the organization goes, stop Twittering, or, of course, that woman who made a comment, an anti-gay comment, and suddenly got yanked from ads. I mean, that slips out, too.
It has a kind of open mic potential that should be apparent to public figures, but isn't always. It will probably be quite apparent to the next generation of public figures, I would imagine.
Well, that brings up the question of how the material in Zero History and the technology we're seeing today relates to politics and how we live our lives. You make a point of going, well, in a sense, we're all become under surveillance. Certainly, people have gotten freaked out by Facebook's surveillance elements, including places. Then there's GPS, which tells you and tells anybody where you are if you've got an iPhone or perhaps your iPad. And after a while, you kind of go, how do we maintain freedom in the face of constantly being watched? I mean, Big Brother is now out there.
I don't know if Big Brother is so much out there as Big Brother is out there and in here, and Big Brother is inherent to the fabric of what we do and possibly isn't even Big Brother anymore. I mean, it may be like Big Brother R Us is where we've already gotten to, if not where we're headed. There are aspects to the digital which we have not yet fully grasped, I think, and some of them are probably very basic, and I don't claim to have grasped them myself, but I think that everything's actually been very different for 20 years or so. A couple of weeks ago, I was at a party, and there was some kind of remarkable architectural feature at the place where the party was being held. And the next day, someone tweeted a photograph of it. And I said, oh, look, this is the thing at the party that I was talking about. And immediately someone in Europe said, that's an iPhone photograph, and you've just given everybody on the planet the exact geographical location of that place. And so I immediately said, unfortunately, it was true, not a private residence, just a rental. I'm sure they wouldn't mind. They want you to rent the place for parties. But I had no idea that each iPhone photograph is tagged with its GPS locator every time you take it. I don't think you can block that. Every time you post one of those pictures, anyone who's over 13 years old and under 35 just goes, oh, yeah, it's right here.
I was at a party, I think, in June, and I was chatting with a 25-year-old who'd gone to the same high school I did, of course, many, many years later. At one point, he said, I can't imagine what it was like in the days when you could walk away and you'd have no chance of communication. And he was talking about the fact that he's got the iPhone, he's got the computer with IM, he's got Twitter, he's got this, he's got that. He's never out of touch. And another friend of mine was telling me that he was in Honduras not long ago, and he and his friend got lost. They're bird watchers. They stopped by the side of the road, and some kid said, I'll get in the car with you and drive you to where you need to go. And he turned on his iPhone and used his GPS and talked with other people elsewhere to find out where they were going. And this was in the jungles of Honduras.
Yeah, I mean, the solitude that the characters inhabit will be very, very something very difficult to understand, if they aren't already, for people, you know, 21st century people reading 20th century novels, that when these people were alone, they were alone. The first thing I noticed about cell phones, and I first saw cell phones being used really ubiquitously in London. I had seen the big Motorola brick cell phones that Hollywood producers used. But then I went to London, and everybody and his brother seemed to have these tiny little pocket telephones. And the first thing I noticed was that the solitude of life in the city had vanished overnight. So that Ezra Pound poem about the passengers in the metro, and he says, petals on a wet black bough. It doesn't make any sense unless each of those people is isolated within in that system. And now they're not. They're talking to their mother-in-law, their girlfriend, whatever.
The difference between, say, yours and my generation and the one before it is that, you know, yeah, we had television, they had radio, but it was still the same world. And the world now seems to have transformed. And sometimes if you blink, it's transformed while you didn't notice.
It's top-down, you know. Television and radio, as we knew them as mass media, are top-down hierarchical structures. It's a broadcast medium. And the Internet is much less of a broadcast medium, if it really is at all. You can use it as a broadcast medium, but that doesn't seem to me to be what it naturally moves toward. We were the audience watching something that had been made for us by a big company, and now we are the audience watching the audience watch the audience.
It's like a permanent breaking of the fourth wall.
Yeah.
A couple of quick questions. First of all, you were on Second Life giving a speech, and I actually watched that speech while your avatar was there. There were all these people dancing in and out. What exactly did you see while you were giving that speech?
I actually tried to pay relatively little attention to it. I had to give the speech, but I would glance up at large screens in this place that we had borrowed, cutting-edge technical college in Vancouver that we had borrowed to do that in. And I was actually in an auditorium where there were hardly any physical people, and they had Second Life going on the screens, but some of the screens showed my really kind of rather ridiculous-looking avatar as from someone else's point of view, and some of it showed the audience as from a point of view slightly behind the back of my avatar's head. And a few times I glanced at the audience, they were levitating and apparently having sex and sword fights and doing things that Second Life avatars do when they meet one another for a lunchtime speech session.
William Gibson, now you've finished Zero History. Have you begun work on another book yet?
No. I'm the way it's come to be. The inception for the first book seems to emerge during or slightly after the book tour for the previous one. I don't know what it is, but perhaps it's physical exhaustion, sensory deprivation, all of the above.
At this stage of the game, do you think we'll be seeing these characters again, or are you going to be moving on into a different milieu?
I never know. I'd be moving on into a different pattern, definitely, if I wrote a fourth book about these particular characters, because I'd be breaking my own pattern. But it's always been more of a pattern than an intent. But we young cyberpunks used to snigger the braided 40-volume mega novels that more mainstream writers were producing. But who knows? Perhaps it's time. My grown daughter actually went a long way toward convincing me when I was having misgivings about doing a third book in this series. She argued quite passionately that it was fun to be had and a good sequel that really couldn't be had in any other way.
You've been listening to an interview with William Gibson, whose latest novel is Zero History. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.